The views expressed in this interview are those of the individuals and do not reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, or the Naval Postgraduate School. Welcome to the Trident Room, brewer of stout conversation, unfiltered and on tap. On today's episode, host Elena Youngblood speaks with Mr. Dino Pick, Director of International Graduate Programs at Naval Postgraduate School, and picks his brain on topics ranging from his own military career to AI and the future of linguistics in operations and diplomacy.
Part one of a two-part episode.
Welcome back, listeners. I am here today with Mr. Dino Pick, who is the Director of International Graduate Program here at NPS. So looking through your bio, it says that you graduated in 1987 from the University of Washington with a Bachelor of Arts degree in Near Eastern Languages and Civilization before serving 29 years in the U.S. Army as a Military Intelligence and Middle East Foreign Area Officer, or FAO. During that time, your tours included serving with the 1st Special Forces Group Airborne throughout the Indo-Pacific region, deployment with the 366 Armored Battalion in Desert Storm from 1990 to 1991, serving with the 10th Special Force Group Airborne during the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and again in Afghanistan in 2009. During all this time, you helped develop the counterterrorism capabilities of the Iraqi and Jordanian armed forces, while serving with the U.S. Embassy in Amman, Jordan, served as a policy officer in the Office of the Secretary of Defense from 2006 to 2008, and focused on partner capacity of the Iraqi security forces, and also became commanding officer of the Defense Language Institute down the street here at Monterey from 2010 to 2014, all while earning a Master of Military Art and Studies from the Marine Corps University and a Master of Arts in Near Eastern Studies from Princeton University, as well as becoming a National Security Affairs Fellow at Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Out of curiosity, what languages do you speak?
So it's a pleasure to be with you, Elena.
Yes.
So I speak Assyrian, Arabic, Farsi, Dari, and just enough German and Spanish to get into trouble.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy. Okay, you currently serve as the Director of International Graduate Programs at Naval Postgraduate School here in Monterey. But within everything that I just mentioned before, you also previously served as Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low Intensity Conflict, and as the First Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations Policy and Programs. Would you mind telling us a little bit about both of those experiences? Those are titles that I don't hear very often.
Sure. The Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low Intensity Conflict is the senior political appointee for special operations in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And I served in that position at the end of the first Trump administration. Before that, I served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations Policy and Programs, which is also a senior civilian appointee position responsible for overseeing the special operations budget, which at that time was about $13.2 billion, and ensuring that the policy direction given by the civilian leadership in the Pentagon is in line with the commander of Special Operations Command's goals and objectives, and that we are ensuring proper civilian oversight.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much. That hit me as very interesting when I was reading your bio. Obviously, you have had a career spanning military intelligence, diplomacy, special operations, policy, and education. If you had to identify a thread that ties it all together, what would it be?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I'll give you the personal thread. So my mother immigrated to the United States from Iran, and my brother and sister and I are first generation U.S. citizens. And we grew up in a house that was very proud to be here in the United States. And at the same time, we were very proud of our ethnic heritage and linguistic heritage from the Middle East. And that really has informed my career arc throughout my life so far. It started with learning Assyrian at home, which is a minority Christian language spoken in Iran, Iraq, and parts of Syria and Turkey, and really having an appreciation for the ethnic heritage of Assyrians growing up. My mother and her family, when they wanted to speak a language the kids couldn't understand, spoke Farsi because they had grown up in Iran. And so what that meant was it was always frustrating to me to hear Farsi, which is a beautiful language, but not understand it. So after graduation from high school, when I went to college, I took a Persian Farsi class out of curiosity and fell in love with the language and ended up majoring in it. So that's how I learned Farsi. At that time, I was in Army ROTC and went on to serve in the Army, as you mentioned earlier. And languages became the passion for me in the Army and beyond. And so whether it was serving in special operations where linguistic and cultural competency is critical, or serving as a military intelligence officer, which is similarly important, those capabilities, to commanding Defense Language Institute as an educator and ensuring that languages and culture were being properly trained and educated, to later doing policy at the Pentagon and ensuring that we were aligning linguistic and cultural training and education with national security objectives, it's all had this thread of a very keen interest on my part about languages and cultures that really stems back to my own heritage and then flows into a passion about U.S. national security and giving back to our country.
Great. Okay, second question. If you were to design a curriculum for rising military and intelligence leaders today, what books or theories would be required reading?
Interesting question. Well, I think that, first of all, today's leadership environment is so challenging and so needing agile, thoughtful leaders that some of the recommendations might surprise you. I think aside from a lot of the Thucydides and Sun Tzu and other military theory, right? The other military theorists that we all read, I would encourage young leaders to become proficient in cross-cultural communication, history, because as we have often heard, history may not repeat itself, but it sure rhymes.
Yes.
And so there are lessons to be learned there. As General Mattis said, learning history gives us an intellectual shock absorber.
I like that. I haven't heard that before.
It's a good one. And Jim Mattis has a lot of good ones. That's one of the better ones.
Yes, he does. I have read his book. It's amazing.
Yeah. And so I think books such as Lexis and the Olive Tree by Thomas Friedman are interesting books about globalization, the effects on culture and societies of modernization and the turmoil that's caused in societies around the world. We certainly are seeing that today, not only here in the United States, but really around the world with political movements that are stemming from a lot of those forces. And so I think leaders that can understand that and understand their societies can be better prepared to engage with the very complex problems they're going to face in the world today.
Thank you. You've played a major role in overseeing U.S. Special Operations Forces. What's something the public consistently misunderstands about Special Operations?
I think certainly an example of what most Americans may not fully appreciate about the Special Operations community is the time that it takes to build a special operator. All of the services take extreme care in selecting and training special operations forces, whether they be Green Berets, Rangers in the Army, Navy SEALs, Marine Raiders, or Air Force Special Tactics folks. They are all mature, highly trained and educated individuals. So the time that it takes to produce that type of highly trained and capable human being and professional is longer than most people, I think, would guess. It's years and years of development. The other point that people may not fully appreciate is the fragility of that special operations person, because I think that in, especially in our Hollywood culture, that special operations personnel are seen as a superhuman, invincible. And while they are extraordinarily capable, resilient, tough, highly trained, and given amazing responsibility in terms of the missions that they undertake, they are human, they're wives, husbands, fathers, mothers. They suffer trauma. And part of my job in the Pentagon as Deputy Assistant Secretary was to take a hard look at the preservation of the force initiatives that had been not implemented as fully as we needed to implement them because of the high operation tempo of the global war on terror. And the wear and tear on our special operators and their families was significant, continues to be an issue. So I think something that Americans can perhaps know is that they are human. They do break. They need time. They need resources to keep that edge and be a ready, capable force for the nation.
Okay. Thank you. That's fantastic. And then along the same lines, what's an unappreciated lesson from Desert Storm, Iraq, or Afghanistan that we still haven't internalized?
Oh my goodness, that's a good question and goes back to the 90s. You know, Elena, what I've actually shared with my son, who's an Army captain, is that the Army that went to war in Desert Storm was the Army that the generation of Colin Powell and Norman Schwarzkopf and other leaders who had grown up as young officers in Vietnam and had seen the failures of strategy and leadership and resourcing in that conflict and had learned from those lessons, they built an amazing army. That army went to war in Desert Storm, and it was built to fight in the Central European plains against the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. And we applied it to the Iraqi army in the desert, and we made short shrift of the Iraqis. We learned some bad lessons from that victory. And some of the lessons that we took away were that we didn't necessarily need to train as hard. We didn't necessarily need to do a lot of the things that Powell's generation had built into us, whether they be vehicle maintenance, gunnery, sergeant's time, developing NCOs and giving NCOs time to be leaders for their soldiers. And then the global war on terror exacerbated those lessons learned because we became an army and a military force that deployed to the combat zone, then came back and did that again and again and again. So we learned a lot of bad lessons along the way about maintenance, about training, because we were in the fight for 20 years.
Those bad lessons being that we didn't give it time for it to develop it.
Yeah. And I think that Desert Storm, the thing that really made us so good in Desert Storm was that we trained in garrison. We resourced units to train, whether it be ammunition, time, leader development. And so as we've come out of the global war on terror now, something we can relearn and are relearning, I think, is that a peacetime military is training for war. Now, what that war will be like, the nature of it, we're always going to be wrong. The question is how wrong. So we need to be thoughtful. And I guess this ties back to your question about leadership, thoughtful about the world environment, the global environment, the nature of threats, and build sort of agility and resilience in our leaders and in our formations.
You're having such a great ability to segue into my next question each time. The comment of not knowing what the warfare is going to be along that vein, is your regular warfare becoming more or less relevant in an era of AI-driven intelligence and great power competition?
Well, you are asking very thoughtful questions, so I'm happy to segue from one to the other. I think that it's a fantastic question. I think that irregular warfare, if anything, is becoming more relevant in an environment where the enemy doesn't want to meet us strength to strength. They want to identify our weaknesses and exploit them, oftentimes referred to as seeking asymmetrical advantage. In an era where the cyber domain is evolving and developing in ways that most of us, certainly me, don't fully understand and appreciate, where the space domain is becoming more important and contested in ways, visible and invisible, and where technologies like artificial intelligence and machine learning and swarms of drones and other technologies are impacting how we compete and how we fight. And on the combat side of it, you need only look as far as the battlefield of Ukraine or the maritime environment in the Black Sea to see how amazingly complex the battlefield is. On the one hand, World War I style industrial trench warfare, soldier on soldier, vehicle on vehicle, artillery intensive. And on the other hand, so terribly modern with drone usage and jamming and cyber attacks, all of that happening on the same battlefield.
And from what I've seen, even the drones themselves, if you want to just speak about the fact that drones are a, I would say, forward-leaning capability,
But then I always think of drones having to be of like the leading material and all of that, but they're not. It's a forward-thinking technology with whatever you can grab. And even that lends itself to the asymmetric piece of it, which is just, it floors me.
Absolutely. Commercial off-the-shelf systems, combining manned and unmanned systems. It's fascinating, and it's evolving so quickly between the sides in the war in Ukraine. But to bring it back to your point about irregular warfare, so there's this notion of the Special Operations Force cyberspace triad. And in that construct where Special Operations Forces and space-based capabilities and the cyber domain are fused in ways that provide us advantage in peacetime, competition, as well as conflict, certainly makes the case for an irregular mindset or an irregular warfare mindset, hopefully helps us think about how an enemy might seek advantage and identify weaknesses. When you look at some of the public cyber attacks on our data and access to our telecommunication systems, you can see that the enemy is not idle and our competitors are not idle, and nor should we be.
Exactly. And then switching gears a little bit, but still talking about advantages, bringing it to the language piece. You've studied multiple languages and spent years working in the Middle East and Indo-Pacific. How does speaking the language of a region change your ability to operate effectively there?
In order to operate effectively in any foreign environment, we need to understand the cultural context, the historical context, try to understand what's going on inside the mind of our enemy, as well as our allies and partners. And to the extent that one speaks the language, it helps beyond measure in not only understanding friends, partners, and allies, as well as adversaries, but it helps build crucial relationships that allow for trust to form. And that trust is a real combat multiplier, both in combat as well as in competition.
Then that trust, maybe being a form of cultural fluency or the ability to have that impact, how does cultural fluency impact military strategy? And with your answer, can you give an example of a moment where that fluency changed the course of an operation or a policy decision?
Sure. So, you know, as I think back on my experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan, two stories come to mind. The first was the invasion of northern Iraq in 2003. So the initial invasion into Iraq to overthrow Saddam Hussein's government. Our unit was at Fort Carson, Colorado, getting ready to deploy to the Middle East, preparing for the invasion of Iraq. And our battalion commander briefed the unit on what to expect. And in the audience were 20 or so contracted Arabic interpreters who had been vetted, screened, cleared for operation with us and there with us. And as the commander described the operating environment we were going to be in northern Iraq, which was an unconventional warfare environment, half of those interpreters stood up and walked out. And that made an impression on me. And the impression was that when we raise our hands and take an oath to defend the Constitution and don the uniform of our military services, it's a solemn thing. And walking away is not an option. And so having organic capability of linguists and cultural expertise, I was one example. There were a handful of others that were uniformed linguists, came with a different commitment than a contractor. So that was one impression. We then went on to successfully infiltrate and operate in northern Iraq, and Saddam's government was overthrown as history. And later, I was working in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, about 4 years later, and I was with a policy review group who had been charged by the Secretary of Defense to look at the training of the Iraqi security forces to determine if we were meeting our goals and objectives to train them. And I remember sitting in a room with these senior policy people from the Pentagon, and they were talking to the local Iraqi police commander, the local Iraqi army commander, and the commanders were speaking Arabic. And the translator, our translator, was getting it wrong. He was misinterpreting what was being said, and so badly that I stopped the interaction and started translating myself. And that, of course, caused
some friction.
Some friction. Well said. It did not make that translator happy. But the result would have been, but for my sort of intervention there, Lord knows what would have come out of that in terms of policy. And what that made me think about was, how many times did that happen? How many times in our conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan were we dependent on a contracted interpreter who got it wrong? So I think that to come back to sort of the impacts of it, it's hard to quantify the impacts, but there's a simple example of one time where we were able to get it more right in terms of the nuances and the meaning of what was being said, and that the policy recommendations that stemmed from that were at the very least based on accurate linguistic and cultural understanding of what had been said. So I'm a diehard believer that there is no replacement for a uniformed, culturally educated, linguistically trained individual. It's not contractor. It's not AI. It's not machine translation. Maybe I'll reserve a small bit of possibility that quantum computing may decades in the future give us something resembling.
My next question was, with tools like AI-driven translation advancing rapidly, do you think language skills will still matter in future diplomacy and intelligence work? I think so, you've covered that.
So I promise I didn't see your questions ahead of time.
No, you have no idea. That's so funny. Okay, well, I guess the answer is yes, they are still very important.
Yes, absolutely. Because, I mean, and just to elaborate a little bit on that, it's language is such a human thing. It is such a human construct used by humans, misused by humans, that to really understand it and use it effectively, it takes a human to do it. That no machine I have seen, and at DLI, we were doing some fairly cutting edge stuff on the automation side. Nothing I've seen even remotely gets us there. You might get a simple rough cut translation if you feed stuff into some machine, but what comes out has to be looked at by a human, has to be proofed. And if it argues for anything, it argues for even higher level proficiency and competency by the human.
Thanks for joining us in the Trident Room. For more information about today's guests and topics, please visit the show notes online at nps.edu/Trident Room Podcast. The Trident Room podcast has been brought to you by the Naval Postgraduate School Alumni Association and Foundation. For questions, comments, and suggestions, please email us at TridentRoomPodcastHost@nps.edu.